Welcome to the Travelling Senorita, episode number 44. As I've mentioned, we're not really flying around the universe right now, but we are grounded, and that is fantastic for me because I get to uncover local stories of where I live, which is in the Tweed in northern New South Wales. And I have found, I believe, probably one of the most authentic storytellers and the source of Curry Country, where we are sitting today. Pay homage and respect to Curry Country and the Bundjalung Nation, where we're sitting in Fingal today. Please welcome my guest, Arabella Douglas.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me on your show. And I'm so excited to be at Fingal, as I just saw some dolphins jumping up a minute ago, which was very nice. And I'm from Fingal Head. I am a sixth generation Aboriginal person who's lived in Fingal Head. I grew up here. I went to school at the local Fingal Head Public School, and I was the fourth generation to attend that school. And it's really a pleasure to be here, looking out in the ocean and looking at this magnificent coastline.
So for somebody that's, I really want to know more about the authentic Indigenous culture of Australia, knowing more about the how it all fits in, the song lines, the stories associated with this incredible age-old culture. Can you please at least give me your little bit, your version of what that looks like for you, Arabella?
Well, I'm a Curry descendant, so my surname, my Aboriginal surname, is likely to have been Curry Curran or Curry Kin Kin. So we take the name Curry, C-U-R-R-I-E, and Curry Country for us is determined by the river systems which border our country. So our country starts at the Bremer River, which is just south of Ipswich, which is not very far from here, about an hour and a half by car. And you follow the Bremer River and you come down the Albert River, which takes you out towards Mulunjali country. You can bear Mulunjali country of Bow Desert. You follow the Albert River down to the Rouse River, which connects to the Tweed River, which we can see on this beach to the left of us. That river system, that aquatic system, is the border of our country. So that's how I know that I'm in country, that I'm on my own country, and this is where I belong, and this is where my ancestors walked, birthed their children, had their families, worked, all within this footprint. Now, how you get a song line and how we kind of, I guess, know intuitively through our own language is I was very lucky that my great-grandmother, whose name is Jane Curry, was recorded by anthropologists back in the 1930s speaking language. The language that she spoke was Minyangbul Mulunjali, which is the dialects of where we are at the moment. And what's also very exciting about understanding that is that in our own family history, and I knew Jane, you understand how a song line works. And I might explain that because I think some people don't understand it very clearly. But to have a song line in your family, and we have our own song in our language that we all learn, it determines how, where your point A or your point B of your land is, so that you know how to travel from point A and point B. The next mob, or the mob that would be between B and C, would have their own language, and it would be able to sing a song to tell you how to move from B to C, C to D, E to F, F to G. Song lines exist all throughout Australia, and different mobs or different clans are responsible for a song line that travels or traverses their part of their country. My song line starts in Mulunjali country, so just at the back of Bow Desert. We sing a song that moves us from Mulunjali country all the way back at the back of Mwollumba down to Tweed, and the last stanza in that song, or the last few words, are the Aboriginal words for Fingal Head. That's how I know I'm on country. So if my ancestors or my grandparents were to tell me where to go or how to move, they sing a song and they tell me which direction to go in. I follow the words of that song, and in that song it moves you from place to place. That's how a song line works. The next nation or the next clan would have a song or a stanza or a verse in their song that would take them from potentially, you know, Ipswich into Yagara country or Yugrapul country or Cubby Cubby country or Bunya country. All of their language in their dialects would have a similar type of song that travels their country. That's how a nation or a mob knows what their boundary is, and it also knows where they are in their place and their purpose. So I'm never lost. I've known for a very long time, I'm almost 50, so all of my life, where my song line is. which will be immovable. It's not determined by a state or a borderline or development. I know exactly where I belong. So at the moment, I'm at the very end or the very tip of my country, and the very top of my country just sits in beneath Ipswich.
Wow. And it's when you're talking about that, I think of modern music or the way that music has been written has got to have come from the ancient art of soul lines.
Oh, there's no doubt. I think one of the questions I was asked not long ago is, how do people know a moving song, so how a travelling song versus other sort of ceremonial songs? And the way that I described it to some young nieces and nephews who were in primary school, and it's kind of like just moving your dial in a radio station in a car. You can move to a station and hear a country station or a classical station or a pop station. You don't need to know all the words of those songs to understand.
You know the genre.
You know the genre.
Yeah.
Song lines work in the same way. Wow. There is a genre for walking or moving song lines, as there is a genre for other ceremonial purposes, weddings, death, sharing culture, arguing or fighting, that sort of ceremonial business. All of those songs, like, you would know the difference. You don't need to know the words to know the difference between a song that would be used in death or mourning versus a song that would be used for a wedding. You don't need to know the words. You could tell by the tone of the song what the purpose of the song is, whether it's light and happy, whether it's about mourning, whether it's about something else. Aboriginal song lines work exactly the same way. I don't need to know the language of another mob. I can determine what their song or ceremony is about by the rhythm of that song.
Wow.
Now, I would be able to determine, as they would be able to determine for us, if I'm singing my travelling song, they would know it's a travelling song and I'm not singing a song about celebration or about mourning, because that rhythm is the thing that's national, which is very exciting when you explore song lines in depth. You will see that mobs have some songs which move, which are about movement, walking, which are about ceremony, mourning, business, a similarity. And that's my song. So my song line song takes me from one area to another. I then know Yagara mob have a similar travelling song, which go from the corner of Ipswich up further to Fassifern into Toowoomba. I know Bunya mob have a similar song, and it's not the words that are similar, it's the rhythm of the song that are similar.
Beautiful. I love that. That's a really, thank you for that. And so, young Arabella, we're sitting on Fingal Beach, and not saying that you're old, really, and we're sitting on Fingal Beach, and Fingal's always been really, I've been up here nearly a couple of decades, and it's always somewhere I've come just as a feeling. I get a really sacred feeling and energy when I'm here, and I know that the indigenous culture here is strong, and I can feel it through the earth. So you have been blessed for landing here as being born here. And what was it like as a young girl running around this beach here?
I think it was great. I think Fingal has always been great. I mean, where we're sitting at the moment, there's a lot of unknown Aboriginal connection and history to Fingal. There are warrior caves in the headland, which were disturbed when mining took place in the 50s, and then they were reburied. So my uncle, Athol Compton, takes people on tours to the headlands to talk about that story. That's a male story. But that's a significant cultural site that exists in the Tweed Coast that people don't know about. There's not enough information about knowing about. So unfortunately, Fingal was mined, like other parts of the Tweed Coast, but the hills were so large, my mother would say when she was a kid, you know, that she would like come down on a piece of iron, you know, or a piece of cardboard down large hills. So you're talking about large valleys and hills that have just been leveled here at Fingal. It also has amazing traditional birthing areas here at Fingal. It has freshwater births, which a lot of people don't know about. There are freshwater soaks all along these headlands, so which is good in times like now where you're concerned about water and concerned about food security. I have none of that fear. Yeah. I know where fresh water is in Fingal.
Yep.
I'm sure a lot of people in the Tweed don't know where they can get fresh water out of the ground. So they're kind of the benefits of understanding how Fingal operates.
Yes.
The fresh water stream from Fingal, which goes across to Yugaribar Island, which is at South Tweed, both of those areas are significant birthing areas. And the reason they are significant birthing areas is because underneath you have fresh water. So women would birth in those areas. And so I think it was very spiritual. It's a healing place for women without doubt. And it's a significant site, I think, historically. And it's a shame that people don't know more about that to really understand that they have incredible stories here.
It's interesting, though, that I mentioned, because you have the history and the culture, and I'm in awe of that. But it's interesting how I pick up on that feeling. I definitely am connected to earth in the sense of, if I know something's not vibing for me, I won't kind of go there. But if I go, you know, if I go to it, we were talking about this off air, when the trees and the ocean, they actually give you so much if you're anxious or you feel that. You know, Fingal's always had that really calm feeling for me as a woman. And I like to come here on my own. I like to be here and seek solace is probably the word I'm looking for. So you mentioned a story to me before about the coloured sands and the Commonwealth Games when you were when you were younger. I love this.
Oh, well, you know, I don't know. There'd be some people in the tweet that would remember this, but some people might not. But the headland used to be full of multicoloured sand. So one of the tourist treats for a lot of the caravan parks in the Tweed Coast used to be bottles filled with coloured, multiple coloured sands. And as a kid, you were constantly filling up bottles and taking them home. And a lot of people at Finglehead Public School did it. In 1982 or 83, when the Commonwealth Games were here, I don't know the year, I forget, but it was early 80s. One of the kids happened to notice there was the Canadian swim team down here at Fingal on the beach, probably having a day off. And so kids, as you do, the teacher from Fingal School, because Fingal School only had two classrooms, but the classes went from like kindy to year six.
And it's literally
six.
A hop, skip and jump right here.
It's right here. Like it's, you know, 200 metres from where we are.
Yeah.
So, of course, the teacher at the time was like, you know, there are... Well, we thought they were famous because they were simply Olympian swimmers, you know. So, you know, come down to the beach to meet them. And so myself and two of my cousins were in the front page of the paper, I think at the time in 1982 or 83, whatever year it was, with the Olympic swim team. And the thing, of course, that we thought to give them as a gift was, of course, just the coloured sand bottles.
They would have loved that.
They're probably thinking, what are these black kids giving us coloured sands for? What is this about? But every time I come here, I think how different the headland looks, because it actually was quite large. The coloured sands were all on this edge. Of course, when you're a kid, everything looks larger. But I wonder where all the coloured sands went, because they've clearly just been, you know, it's now in the ground somewhere else. But it was a highlight.
You were in search of those coloured sands.
So it was, I mean, I spent a lot of time out here. We would camp out here, like just behind our houses. I lived in Letitia Road. So we would, you know, summertime was putting a tent out and coming out and swimming and getting fish. And Fingal seemed a very long way from Tweed Heads in those years. It's 12 kilometres physically. But it seemed a great distance, you know. So a lot of my childhood was, you know, here, Cabarita, Wooyong, all of this side, not necessarily the Gold Coast. I don't ever remember really going to Gold Coast beaches very much when I was young, other than the occasional family event, which was done at Burleigh Hall, which had a Bora Ring next to it when I was a kid, you know. So, and I think the Bora Ring's still there, but a lot of people would have their weddings and engagements at that hall. But I spent most of my time in the Tweed Coast, Coogeon Creek, you know, Kingsclere, Fingal, and these areas. So it was exciting for me.
As they say, it's God's country. Not sure who coined that.
Yeah.
Moving forward now. So when you leave school and you decide to, because having spent a fair bit of time with you in this weekend, which I've really, really enjoyed, you've got an academic brain. It's just natural for you to sort of seek out knowledge. So where did you decide to, what did you decide to do in your 20s? Where did you go to uni? What did you do?
Well, I went to, my first year of high school was at Tweed River High, which is a local school, and then I went to Sydney for the rest of my high school and university. But I would always come back. All my family's all in the Tweed. So, you know, I would come back for every holidays, you know, come back when I could afford to fly myself, which was from about 16 or 17, come back, go out with my cousins, all of those sorts of things. So even in
country, right? You would miss it if you're in the city, I imagine.
I think once you know you're a saltwater person, like once you have a relationship with your environment, it's very difficult to find those sensations artificially anywhere. You know, you might be distracted for a while, but it doesn't resonate in the same way. So I moved from Finglehead with my mother, with my sister, down to Woolmaloo, which was a housing commission area in Sydney, kind of in the CBD, you know, like it's very close to the city. So we moved from here to there, and I think it was the first time I did an interview a few years ago about this, and I think for me it was definitely the first time that I realised we were poor. I'd never felt that in the Tweed Coast. I never felt as though we were poor, even though I went to a very small school in a very small location.
You were always rich with nature. Like, what is poor?
I think that was the first time. I mean, Woolloomooloo is like in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. Mm. So you're around other indicators of have and have not. Mm. And I remember being quite, because I was 12, I was 13, I think, when we moved down there. So first year after year seven, so whatever age you are there. I jumped a class when I was at school. So I was always like the youngest in my year. But I remember distinctly feeling like, wow, we're poor, and I had no idea.
Yeah.
And I think regional communities are quite lovely in that regard, because class systems aren't always as obvious.
And
I think if you're a regional kid, and Tweed Coast is still considered regional in a lot of ways, even though we're 10 minutes from an international airport.
That's right.
I think that there's a luxury in that, because class divide is not as obvious. You do get the luxury. I mean, you know, I would take sandwiches to school, which were like, you know, prawn sandwiches and crab sandwiches. I think about that now and it's kind of crazy, but that didn't seem like a loss or a poor way of eating when I was even young. But the truth is, all my friends were taking bought food to school, and we had a household that, you know, and we still do that now, called food exchange between our own family. So if my husband caught some fish yesterday, you saw some of that.
Yeah.
You know, he's given that to some aunts this morning. Gorgeous. That is very common, and that's very much the way I grew up in Fingal. People would be working on the farms or through Coogeon, all those areas, picking. People would come home and pick. I went out picking beans when I was a kid with my aunts and uncles, you know, like the kids on school holidays. So we would go out working with people. We'd probably do one bucket to their 15,000 buckets. Like, yeah, they were so quick,
yeah,
as adults.
Yeah.
But it was fun. So I grew up on the Coogeon farmland as well, and going picking beans and other things out there, but mostly bean picking. And you would get excess, like the farmers do in a regional area, and you would share between your neighbours. That process of sharing is something we still do. So if we go out and get yuggery or pippies, we go out and get oysters, or somebody will drop by and give us oysters or give us fish. That still happens. That happened when I was growing up in Fingal a lot. So you had a very shared sense of abundance. So when people were abundant, they had excess of something,
yep,
they were very happy to share. When you move to, and we still practice that, and I feel that that's a very much an Aboriginal way of living and existing, because if you know that you can be fed by others, and you know that if you don't have, someone will help feed you, it does give you a sense of security. Even though we had not a lot of money when we lived at Fingal, I never felt as though our fridge was bare and we were without things. But that's probably because a lot of our food was supplemented by graciousness of other people, and that's just how you lived.
So when you go to Woolloomooloo, and you, I guess it's a really impressionable age, 12, 13. And so is it sort of like that time of your life that it became a bit of a disconnect, or?
I think because I used to always come home, I mean, I think it would be different if I just went away and never visited back. That would be different. But I was always home throughout my teenage years and my 20s. But it certainly was powerful in that I understood that we were poor, and that had its limitations, you know, at that time. And but then, you know, Woolloomooloo is an extraordinary place. And I remember, I mean, you know, I've got very good friends still from Woolloomooloo. There's a reunion everyone has every year still at Woolloomooloo. It was dynamic and exciting to be there, even being a kid, because, you know, there was Elizabeth Waimara, who does black comedy. Her and I grew up together, close together. 16, the biggest impact for me, there was a guy called John McGrath who owns McGrath Real Estate. He's from Woolloomooloo. John, we used to all play touch football at Centennial Park with some other people. He was obsessed with Tony Robbins, which is a guru about life changing.
Oh, well, here so, we go. This is a very juicy part of the story.
Yeah, well, that was one of the biggest impacts of my life.
Yeah,
you know, being around that clique, we all played touch football, you know, so I was not only a player, but used to be the manager for the team called Woolloomooloo Warriors, the girls' team. So all the girls were going to, you know, to school in Willara, you know, St. Scholastica, St. Catherine's, you know, all the sort of public Catholic schools, you know, that sort of thing. All the boys were going to St. Mary's in Woolloomooloo, that's, you know, or Waverley. Even though the Housing Commission kids, we all played sport together in the eastern suburbs. So touch football was big, netball was big.
So with this, I'm just picking up on something here. With the John McGrath and the Tony Robbins.
Yeah, huge influence in my life.
Yeah, so in what way?
Well, John was starting out then. I probably shouldn't be a story about John McGrath, but I'm sure John won't hate me for saying it. But
it's how it sparks you. This is
what happens. So we're all kind of a clique together, like all around the same age and vintage. John's a bit older than me, and there were older boys, etc. But John was starting out in real estate. I think he was 19 and bought his own real estate agent. He was obsessed with a guy who was in real estate, because actually Tony Robbins used to talk real estate. He didn't talk personal guru. He started in real estate. And John was obsessed with him and bought a ticket to get on the same flight as Tony Robbins, which was very impressive, you know, blah, you kind of thinking. But it was the first time someone ever asked me in that group. We were all kind of thinking, what do you want to be in your life? What do you want to do in your life? Who do you want to be? I had no idea. I remember Mrs. Finn, who I think still teaches in the Tweed, once told me in English, you should be a writer. You know, that's what you should do. Wow. And so my whole goal at that point when I was in high school was to write at university. I thought I wanted to be a writer. The biggest degree was a communications degree at UTS at the time. That was when your grades were out of 500, so it's a long time ago.
Yeah. I remember these days.
Yeah. So that was my focus, like that my once upon a time a teacher said I should write.
Wow. Right.
The truth is, I wanted to be Prime Minister. I would tell Mr. Witherspoon at Finglehead Public School that I wanted to be Prime Minister. Now, it wasn't a great reason.
Encouraged?
I wasn't encouraged. Mr. Witherspoon had an alcohol problem, God bless his cotton socks. I didn't know that. But he was a very interesting teacher for Fingal. You know, he would make us do things like look for something in a phone book as a class, you know, like where you're just constantly looking for problem solving. But I probably annoyed the hell out of him. I used to always say, you know, can I rearrange the library? Can I do this? Can I do that? I love school and I didn't like going home. I didn't have a very nice home. There's a lot of domestic violence in my home. And so my reaction to that when I was a kid was to spend as much time in school under any reason, guys, proposition whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So a teacher never had to ask me more than once to do anything. I was always looking for an opportunity not to go home. Yeah. So when people say, oh my God, you know, I have a lot of degrees, I'm doing a PhD, I'm very well educated from anyone's point of view, but that is not driven by my desire to be that. It's actually a reflection of an environment I wanted to escape. And as a kid, you don't have many options. You're either at home or you're at school.
Yes.
I didn't want to be at home, so I very much was geared towards being at school, not realizing that my joy of learning, I loved learning, I still love learning. You know, I don't even know how many years I've been a student. It would be far too long to even count, but much more than any high school education. I've been in tertiary education, so multiple degrees, etc. So it's a long time. And it's not, and I often say this if I do give tours or lectures to school kids about what makes a successful person or how do you inspire people. I'm doing something for AIM online very shortly in a couple of weeks, which is the Aboriginal Island Mentoring Experience, you know, Indigenous Mentoring Experience. So I always say to people that just because your environment might be challenging at home, school can provide solace for you, like the beach, if you kind of think of education as your own journey and you can control that. So I always loved education. Keeping me at school and being engaged with school was not an issue, but it was not propelled by something positive. It was reaction to the experiences of being involved in domestic violence within my home.
Yeah. And so when you left high school, and you had a little bit of impressions from some pretty iconic people in the sense of business. What did you think you wanted to do? Did you still want to do
communications? Well, this is what happened. This is what happened. So, you know, we get to meet Tony Robbins. We go to No Names in Sydney, which is I think they closed it down after 50 years, but it used to be the place where people would go for, you know, spaghetti bolognese.
Trust me, I've been there several times.
No Names is great.
We might have been there at the same years. Probably. We're vintage same.
So John McGrath was obsessed with Tony Robbins. Tracked him down, they had a conversation. He brought Tony Robbins to Australia. They became friends. We all, as a group, all went out to No Names. Tony Robbins is an extraordinarily tall man. And his book at the time was Awaken the Joint Within, which is with a really bad haircut at the front. Like, it was pretty daggy, right? Yeah. But it was life-changing. My mum left me to live by myself in Woolloomooloo when I was 15. So she left. left and had a relationship and did other various things. And so I had to pay rent, housing commission rent, go to school.
On your own in
work,
this house?
Yep. And so I started working at Norman Bar's Ice Cream when I was 14. I'd lied about my age so I could be employed.
And me too. Mine was in a bar, though.
Yeah, well, Ice Cream Scooper was my first job. And I did it, and I did it at King's Cross because it was the hours with the, it was a shop with the longest hours that were open. They were open till like 1 o'clock. Anyway, so I think I was like managing that store, and about a year later, like, and had, I was earning a lot of money at the time, like $130 there. Yeah. Then I would earn like Saturday money, and then I had a Sunday job at the International Hyatt, which was a big hotel where the Coca-Cola sign is in Sydney.
Yep, I'm right with you here on the visual.
I had to work. There was no, you know, I am a workaholic. I still do a lot, but it's always been my nature to do a lot. I had to do a lot. My mother wasn't paying my rent. You know, I had to pay rent, electricity and a phone, which were my three fun and food, my four fundamental bills, while go to school. We were all playing touch football, as I said. And Anthony Robbins became, via John, an extraordinary mind shifter in how I understood myself. And for the first time, so where I told Mr. Witherspoon I wanted to be Prime Minister, basically because I wanted to be able to change the laws, because I knew of domestic violence, and I used to ring the police and I would see what happened as a child, and my child brain would say, well, if I was the Prime Minister, I could fix this, right? It was only when I was about 15 did I research all of the Prime Ministers of Australia and found out the majority of them were in fact lawyers. So I thought, oh, well, that's very interesting. You know, like, I didn't know that. And so it was through when I was about 16 that I thought, no, I actually want to be a lawyer. That's what I want to do. And I had never said that publicly or openly, because we didn't know any lawyers when I was growing up. There used to be a guy who was an absolute crook in the Tweed, who's got a stool of practice here, that fraudulently sold my grandmother's property and would manipulate black people and all of that. Still in the Tweed, still has a practice, a long time lawyer. That was probably the only lawyer that a lot of people knew, you know, in the area, that you might use for conveyancing a property, potentially you might use for a will. That was it. So I didn't know any professional people. We didn't have doctors and lawyers in the family or other types of professions. We never spoke about university when I was growing up. In fact, no one ever spoke about university in Fingal Public School at all, because to become a teacher, you went to an equivalent of TAFE. You went to a college. You didn't have to attend university back in those days to even be a teacher. Even in Tweed River High School, and now I've just had my stepdaughter graduate, she's now in her first year of university, so I can say they haven't really improved either at Tweed River, encouraging all their kids to go to university. So it was not a common discussion.
Is it something you would have discussed with John McGrath and
For sure. We all did. We did, and that's what happened. So Tony's whole book was about, you know, Awaken the Giant Within. If you've never read it, you should read it. I went to see Tony Robbins again in New York last year. It used to be on late night infomercials. It wasn't glamorous, right? But for a kid who does
it, awakens the giant within.
It does. So we all kind of did these really bold, what do you want to be, what do you want to do type thing. You know, John was, I want to conquer the world in real estate. And he actually effectively went on to do that. John McGrath is a very successful real estate mogul, does amazing things, amazing guy. Another very good friend of ours who was in that group, you know, whose name is Steve Dack. Him and I both chose law. And unfortunately, Steve, he did work for Chris Murphy. And, you know, unfortunately, he took his own life and there were various things. But we were both excited by each other because we thought he lived two doors up from me in Woolloomooloo, and his other brother is a guy called James Dack, whose wife owns all of Hungry Jack's in Australia, very wealthy people, and he worked with John for a number of years, etc. So James was the coach of Woolloomooloo Warriors, the girls team. I was the manager and a player. You know, we're all interconnected, but being involved in, they were like 18, 19,
and they're
I'm 16.
They weren't go-getters,
they were visionaries, able to be visionary, all hardworking, and then along comes somebody who kind of goes, well, who are you about and what are you about, right? What do you want to do? And you can choose anything. And it's, even if you ask a person now, who are you and who do you want to be, most people aren't comfortable saying out loud what their true ambition may be. And so it was the first time and I was self-parenting by that age, right? So it was the first time someone was asking, what do you want to be and what do you want to do? My motivation then was for justice. I was obsessed with criminal law, domestic violence, violence issues. I was trying to remedy things in my own experience. That was my desire. So started I got into a communications degree, which was very hard to get into. I was there for a year feeling very dissatisfied. This is at UTS. And I was working for a fashion company by that stage, because on my board back when I was 16 and 17 was, I want to travel, I want to work in fashion. I used to do some modelling down at Grace Brothers and Meyer down in the centre, like on the weekend, again,
love,
for money.
Love a bit of Grace Brothers.
Oh, well, you know, you do. I was, if anyone would pay me anything to do anything, like more money, I was looking for a way to do small hours, yeah, and maximise my amounts, because I had bills to pay. Yeah. So that was my, motivation, my key motivation. So went there. Was working for a fashion company, importing fabrics, you know, doing lots of stuff in fashion, doing styling, different things. And I knew it wasn't what I wanted to do, because the communications degree was actually geared towards working in journalism as opposed to writing, which was really my deeper love. So I thought, well, what shall I do? And my boss was like, well, don't ruin, you know, your arts degree. Like, and then I started, but well, I'll just finish art and do arts law and whatever. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's how that kind of journey came about. Then I started working.
So you added law to the communication degree?
Yeah.
Right.
I was two separate degrees, but I added law so I could use my credits and my communications towards an art degree. And in that, I had majored in Aboriginal studies and theology. And in my law degree, I first started my career in criminal law. And then again, the influence of a mentor, because that's one of the strategies that Tony Robbins always tells you to do.
Right, yeah.
Make friends with the people who you want to be like.
Yeah.
Find out how they live their life and what are the behaviours. So I knew that from 16. So I took a very different view about who do I want to get to know, who's living the life that I want, how do they do it, how does that work. I never found a model of understanding my Aboriginality and my connection in that time zone,
yeah,
between the ages of, say, 16 to 25,
yeah,
I think. And it was only when I was at university, I wrote a paper on genocide. I got to present at a conference in a place called Valadalen as an undergrad, which is northern Sweden. And it was an Indigenous Peoples Conference. And it did two things. Changed my politics about understanding racism, because I was able to see First Nations Indigenous people who were blue-eyed, white-skinned. They had a parliament with dedicated seats. They had a number of other behaviours in northern Europe. So their country goes through Sweden and Norway. So Nordic or Sami people is their name, you know. So experiencing that and going to Sweden, I stayed in Sweden in Gothenburg for a while after that. Then I think I didn't come back because John Howard might have been Prime Minister then. I remember feeling distraught about that. There are a number of things going on. But the evolution of my thinking, my global politics about race and myself and identity and racism, definitely started to form in my last teenage years, in my early 20s, when I was understanding the globe more, when I was understanding how racism worked. You never saw black girls on magazines, on billboards or anything. I was friends with Denny Hines at the time. She went to St. Vincent's at Potts Point. She was like an exotic black. Marsha Hines was an exotic black. She was with George Negus at the time. So there was like this clique of,
yeah,
other things. But even in that space, being black and Aboriginal was not identifiable.
Yep.
You didn't know what that looked like. So if someone had said to me when I was 17 or 18, put images of Aboriginal women on your board for magazines, you would find none. There was no narrative around what that looked like. The idea, and again, this is what happens. Life always gives you what you want. You just got to be open to it.
Yep.
I was working at the Hyatt, a high-end boutique.
A little bit of patience.
Working at the Hyatt, that was my Saturday job. High-end, like very, you know, the Hyatt was one of the top hotel chains at that time, right? So wonderful boutique, taught me a lot about labels and, you know, got my first Louis Vuitton wallet then, I think, whatever, you know, all sorts of things. In walks this incredible, glamorous, like you've never seen, out of this world, gorgeous black woman, dripping in diamonds. Anyway, I'm in this boutique. She comes in, she spends a lot on a black American Express card, which I knew she had a lot of money then. Comes again the next day, and she just is wanting this conversation about my blackness. You know, where are you from? You know, are you going to university? There are black. She told me for the first time, I'd never heard of them, that there are black universities in the United States. I'd never heard of such a thing. And no one ever spoke to me like that before. She said, you know, you're incredibly beautiful. You know, if you came to the US, you know, a doctor or a lawyer would snap you up. And, you know, like, she was very, it was such a contrast to any other black female conversation I'd had in my whole life. I never saw a black skin, dark black skin woman dripping in diamonds like I had seen her. Never been interested in me and my blackness. Never had asked me to define it. Like, what is it about? Like, never told me I was beautiful. Had no notion of that. That is not a conversation or a reflection that white Australia was giving to black girls in the 80s and the 90s, early 90s. You had none of that. Anyway, we became friends. Her name was Melissa, and she came in every day. And her husband was a businessman, and she used to just follow him around. She was highly university educated. She was university educated, highly educated. And she said, you know, you can marry well. And she kind of said to me, you know, you can marry well and travel with your husband. I do that. Or you can have your own career. And she just gave me this totally different conversation.
Yeah.
Never had it before. No one was having those conversations. So that was another part. When people say to me, who has influenced you the most? This woman whose name I now don't even know.
Yeah.
I can't recall.
Yeah.
Had such an impact to me over a period of like 3 or 4 days that I saw her. It was profound. It was life-changing. I met Gough Whitlam many years later, and I was a huge Gough Whitlam fan, at the celebration of the Native Title legislation down in Canberra. And he happened to sit with me for breakfast. I was so excited because, you know, I'd just been a huge fan. So I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And he did say something incredible to me. I mean, I was interested in land rights, and I understood what that meant. I understood what human rights was about. I was interested in those spaces. He said to me, never underestimate the power of a small audience. And I never forgot that, because impacting people is not in the volume and the number. It's in the intimacy of having the conversation to see people differently and allow them to see themselves differently. So, fast forward my career.
Just on that though, it's that exchange that you and Melissa
amazing.
Had in that 3 day that you said. So the openness of you, and because one thing my father did teach me was you always ask your way to success, right? In that sense.
That's good too.
You know, and he said a whole lot of other
profound things.
No, not profound, other way. But let's not go there. But what you were doing was interacting with her. You weren't being shy and meager, and you know, she was talking to you, and you were answering her, and she was seeing the gold in you as well. Like, encouraging that.
I think just seeing the global magnificence of black women.
Yes.
I had never been in that conversational lane before. You know, I've now lived in the US. I've lived overseas. I've done various things. I worked on Barack Obama's campaign as an Australian lawyer in Florida when he was going up against Hillary on the Democratic nomination. That was exciting for me. But most of my time was working with African American communities, re-enrolling them to vote. And they were mortified and shocked. I was living in a gated community. My partner at the time was an African-American man, which would be considered, you know, middle class or upper middle class and executive. And he was frightened for my life. You know, like, why are you going door knocking and helping and getting people enrolled? And I was just like, I was working for Lizzie Taylor Lawyers in Sydney, but they were allowing me to work remotely for them. And this was, I think, in 2008, 2009, something like that. And I was very, I didn't meet Barack Obama, but I did meet Michelle, so that's good enough for me.
Yeah,
But I was very excited to have a black president globally. Like, that was its own payoff to me. What was shocking to me is every African American household that I would go to, how fearful they were to get behind a black president and for him to be elected. And that taught me a lot about my own politics as well, how that works. They didn't know black people even existed in Australia. Is Australia a black country? Like, there was a lot of that going on. So that globalization of my thinking definitely came from being at university, going over to Europe, meeting white-skinned Indigenous people, understanding Indigenous people as a global context of 500 to 600 million people, understanding blackness, how it's globalized, seeing that, of course, then I, you know, rethought what had happened with the civil rights movement, Charles Perkins taking the bus out to Moree, the head of the Supreme Courts in New South Wales was a university student who worked with Charles at the time. And what people don't tell you about the civil rights movement and Charles Perkins doing the Moree bus rides is that that was directly influenced by the civil rights movement, which was for the first time being broadcast in Australian TVs because people were finally having television. So what I realised then, and what is happening even now with Black Lives Matter, is that what happens is that sometimes when you're viewing an external race debate with black skin people, it either mobilizes or mostly it informs, and sometimes it shapes how black people within your own country are talked about, understood, etc. It's like suggesting that Leave It to Beaver helped inform Australian households how to be nuclear, male, female, CSI, CIS, yeah. Two-parent family. That TV show in and of itself helps inform how people may behave. In the same way, the civil rights movement informed and inspired a mobilising of a bus movement out to Moree to challenge racism in Australia. There is a relationship. Meeting Melissa helped me understand that I could see myself in a broader black context and understood my own life ambition in a much broader way.
That's so global, and you've read that book, which I can't wait to read, because I fully know where you're coming from. From me not knowing a lot about Indigenous culture growing up and studying archaeology and anthropology, and then literally going, I'm not finding out what I need to find out. I went and lived in London for 2 years, and I remember seeing tall, beautiful black women walking past me on the street, in the high street, that were not flashed with diamonds, but they were models, and they were, like that, and I loved that, and I felt for once in my life really connected to the world, which I hadn't seen in Australia. So this actually is a good segue to go into Curry Country and where you're at now, which is there's a big picture to paint here, but you started on a journey via your mum's wish. About 10 years ago, was
that? About 12 years ago now. So, but what happened is my mother, I guess I should just finish my career part. But anyway, you know, I did work for Treeshire Council as a lawyer there in salt development, which is fine. You know, I continued doing
book.
That.
This is definitely a book.
But my career then went back to the corporate environment. I've been in a senior executive with government before, so doing large reform programs across the state, you know. So I specialised in environment and planning law, and I should tell you this story. I was in crime, doing criminal law, public criminal work, which was great, and you know, you're passionate about doing it. Again, following the principle of getting mentors who help advise, I've always had a career mentor in different areas that I've always sought to be involved in. So I have my own consulting business, Douglas & Associates. I sit as a professional director on various boards. My heart work is the organisation or the cousin consortium known as Curry Country. So I'm an economist as well, I have a business degree, and I'm doing a PhD in economics at the moment at Griffith University, which is on the Gold Coast.
So, I'm so glad you put that bit in.
Yeah.
It's a bit remiss of me to jump forward there.
Yeah. But all those bits, all your experiences in life, help inform how you behave and how you react and how you shape yourself. My Aboriginality has been well-founded because my family has always been black. I've always been Aboriginal. I've always known a lot about my history. But articulating that and bringing that to life in the things that I do, either professionally or in a purposeful way, like with Curry Country, comes from me being able to align and manage both my interests and my passions. I know that if you do things that come from your heart, you are pulled in that direction. You're drawn and you're propelled. It's the way you inspire yourself. If you do heart work, no matter what it's in, you'll be okay, because work won't feel like work and money comes. I had a very good mentor who said do environmental law as a specialty, because it sits in the Supreme Court jurisdiction in New South Wales, which means you get dedicated judges. They're very technical, which means they only look at this type of legislation. Environment and planning law is their only part of the legislation they need to be concerned with, and they become specialists in that. For example, in Queensland, judges who sit in the environmental court also sit on matters of civil matters or criminal matters, so they're not dedicated judges in the Queensland system. So my advisor at the time, my legal mentor, was like, specialise in that. A, there are not enough women in it. There are no Aboriginal women in it. It's technical. Your brain works very well in that. Do that. So that's why I became an environment and planning lawyer. I did that. I love that. I work for councils. I work for developers. But in that mix of environmental law is an area known as social sustainability, which sort of sits with environmental sustainability. And social sustainability is about finding social value as you both develop and move, but also having social value in what a tree might be worth, or what a park might be worth, or what a beach might be worth. And you bring that reality through an economic conversion into the value of the opportunity. So that's when you get to talk about things like, what is the value of the Great Barrier Reef? What is the value of fresh air? So that, for me, brought together my Aboriginal theology, my Aboriginal spiritual beliefs, into a place that I can feel genuinely compelled to work in, because it's completely aligned with my value system. So one might say, oh, is that the same as being an environmental lawyer? No, it's not, because social value is larger than the environment. It's a social interplay and reaction of both culture and people. So you do things like you develop salt and you make sure that there are free areas so that you don't have to be rich to use very good areas. You don't have to be rich to come and have a barbecue on the area. It's not a gated community. It's accessible to everyone irrespective of their socioeconomic position. That's what social value is about.
Right.
So I work in those areas still, advising companies on social value and environmental and social impact. I still do that. So my own businesses, I do that. But I am a legal strategist or a business strategist, so I problem solve. And normally, environmental, social, or one of those elements is a miss in that. And I specialise in governance around that. So the decision makers and the boards.
It's a really holistic approach.
It is. It's good. So, and what's exciting for me is that all the work that I do comes from my heart. I'm genuinely interested in solving it because I get to use a range of ways in which to look at through a different lens and solve the problem. So my PhD is on race bias and investment decision making. I'm trying to influence governance models and decision makers on how they assess a problem, looking at both their own racial bias and looking at social value as the benefit. So that's what my PhD is about. So I spend a lot of time in big business doing that. When my mother passed away, this is how Curry Country came about. When my mother passed away, she asked me, would I organise the family, the Curry family? Now, that for a nuclear family, that might seem pretty easy, but for an Aboriginal family, that's extremely complex. And she knew that I did large-scale project work. I worked for Lendlease. I started Barangaroo. They're a social sustainability manager and reordered that whole site. I still do have them as a global client, so I still do work for them in their different businesses. But she said, you know, can you organise the family? And I kind of resisted that. So my mum passed. I resisted doing anything for nearly 2 years, a year and a half, 2 years, because I just didn't have the energy. And then I thought, what I need to do is I need to answer every question that I would have had growing up about my culture and what it means both in all its manifestations. So the theology of it, the native title elements of it, land boundaries, language boundaries, social values. So that when kids are growing up now, I feel that Aboriginal kids, there's a lot of demand on knowing specifically where they're from, how they originated, what their language means, etc. When I was growing up, those demands weren't as pronounced. I could tell people I was Aboriginal and they would be okay with that. But of course, since the native title legislation came in 1993, there's been more of an understanding in Australia about different nations and the nuances inside what that might mean. And because I'm familiar with that, because I know that, it seemed very logical for me to build a framework that people in the family, so the business model is called a cousin consortium. So Curry Country is built around multiple small business operators who are all connected biologically to James and Ellen Curry. But the specialty or the backbone of all of their work is that they are on country and the sovereign owners of the country in which they're operating on. And that looks like native food, cultural burning, environmental businesses, advising businesses on cultural awareness or cultural education. It's a range of things. But all of my family members who have small businesses were all doing it as an individual rather than as a collective. Yes. Curry Country is like the Black West farmers. It's simply the umbrella for multiple small business operators. And it all comes from the ground where we're sitting on at the moment. And because it's my specialty as a strategist That's what I do naturally. That's what other people pay me to do. It would seem sensible that I should do that for my own family. And that's what I've done. So I've created our own economy, our own formulas and values. And we started this 12 years ago by bringing the family together, ordering the family. So there are 8 main lines in the curry family. All has a different color. We get together every year and do a curry convoy on our own country so that we're constantly educating everybody in our family, which is almost 3,000 people, about their own history in a very particularized, deliberate way. Why do you do that? Because as they grow and develop and become that woman in their 20s or young man in their 20s, they both have this backbone of rich Aboriginal context to who they want to be and what they want to do.
And something I just absolutely applaud your work within your own family.
Thank you.
I just think it's not enough of it. And you and I spoke about this yesterday. And you said, well, tell me more about your culture. You know, and there is way much. There is way more there. I'm an Australian. No, there is.
You know, who are you really?
That's right. And when I touched on where some of my heritage came from, you wanted to know more about that, just because I should know it.
Yeah.
To share with you the way you've shared with me
about
curry country, because you're aware of it and so are all the lineage down aware of it. So something that now that we've shared this experience, I was always digging and I'm going to dig deeper. I want to know more about my culture so that you and I can have a coffee one day and chat about that as well, which is, you said it's pretty much an obligation that you have within yourself and your tribe to do this.
This is the gift, right? You know, so there is such a demand on Aboriginal people, Indigenous people globally, to know the intricate natures about who they are, how they are, how did they get here, when did they get here. I mean, I can tell you where James and Ellen were living from 1810. Physically, I can go to that place. That's how much of a demand on me there is to know how much I need to know. It's not just I need to know what area. There's a demand on knowing person and place. So I know where they were and who they were before Queensland became its own state. So when a non-Indigenous person in Australia says, what can I do because I want us to be a great Australia, a forward-thinking Australia, a integrated Australia, a happy Australia, the gift you can give Aboriginal people is know completely who you are. Because the more you do that, the more you allow me to have oxygen and be Aboriginal on my own place. But the moment you fail to do that, the moment you want to sit there and say, I'm Australian and I'm happy with non-defining that and I can just be, it's the more you're going to fight to have oxygen on this country.
I agree.
But I need the oxygen here because you have multiple places in which will embrace you, have history that you will find your grandparents were in 1788.
Yes.
I don't have that option. This is my only option.
Yeah.
So I don't say that Australia is not for sharing. I'm just saying don't take the oxygen from Aboriginal people on this continent. And the way that you gift them that joy is by finding out intimately who you are.
And the gift.
And telling your kids that so that they don't then go, oh, no, we're all Australian together.
Yeah.
No, I want the kid who comes beside me and goes, you know what, I live in Australia. I'm loyal to, I love it. But my history is here, here, and here. And we're so excited we found these things out.
Yeah. And you know what your gift is? Actually, just telling me that was a real gift. And now we're telling other people.
So tell other people. Get it out there.
Yeah, I'm right with
that's
you,
that's your
Arabella.
Gift. You don't need to know more about my culture. I'm happy to do that homework for myself.
Yeah.
But what you can give to me as a fellow Australian is know exactly, intimately, where you are and who you're from.
Thank you for that. So let's go to Indigenous tourism.
Yes.
Because something that I reckon I have this, I can feel it in my waters, that you, I can feel it in my finger waters, that you and myself and whoever else is with us, maybe collaborating on some really cool Indigenous tourism aspects for the Tweed. Something that I've been trying to kind of, it's been marinating over here, but meeting you has just really, for me, it's given me a full circle of where it can go. So can you drill down a bit into what you and your gorgeous husband Sean do with Pippies and just an example of what you do there, say with somewhere like Pippet, an award-winning restaurant.
All right, yeah. Okay, well, I think one of the one of the things that a lot of people in the family were already doing when we devised Curry Country, because there's Curry Country and Curry Foundation. So the Curry Foundation has representatives of all of the lines, and they focus on things like, I provide a lot of information and heritage and historical information. We've got anthropologists in the family, archaeologists in the family, engineers in the family, doctors in the family, lawyers in the family. I think we've pretty much got every vocation you can imagine that's a Curry person. But getting them to contribute to a foundation in a way that's meaningful, so that we have explored all the medicinal qualities of foods, for example, from our own family perspective, so they can be positioned against contemporary health knowledge, and we share that as people get ill, or what's going on, what are our own native or natural remedies, what are our principles for understanding anxiety. So we constantly are balancing those things with our own deep knowledge, our own family knowledge, and the contemporary application of those things. The foundation owns all of Curry Country knowledge, history, all of that. So the foundation is representatives of all of the family. Curry Country is the action or the businesses that sit underneath it. One of it is native food. So we did a whole journey on native foods, both health use, medicinal use, and all of those things. People then were doing tours on foraging. So there's a number of people in the family that do foraging on different headlands, on different beaches, in different areas. I knew that they were interested in doing that, and of course then my job is to work out how can they connect with people who are inspired to use native produce. So I approached a number of amazing chefs. I had a list of 15 chefs who were in our footprint, because we believe in food sovereignty. So I don't sell to food or whatever outside of our footprint. We don't go into other nation stuff. They've got to be their own leaders in those things.
Yes.
I approached different amazing chefs. We knew the Devlin family, so that's Ben. We knew Shay, his cousin, who has a business down in Byron, where they do weddings and things like that. So they've been in the area for a long time. He was at Halcyon House at the time that I met Ben, before he opened Pippet, but Pippet was on the horizon.
Yep.
And people were interested in learning about native foods, how to forage it. I mean, these things, for example, are edible. Like, these are leaves that you can eat.
Yep.
A lot of people don't even know that, you know. So that's one of the things that Pocket Herb is interested in exploring and using.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So we took all of our traditional information and knowledge, partnered up with some amazing chefs who were like, I want to explore that and become really good at preparation and understanding it a bit better. What can we use and what can we do? That led to yuggeries, which is a really common, which are pippies, you know, which is really common in the area. Ben has a restaurant. Pippet is no hoof, so he has a particular menu type.
Yep.
And was interested in having a look at pippies and yuggery. And so our relationship went from doing that to now we have an experience with Pippet where we will take you out to get yuggeries with us for an hour or so. Mm-hmm. Your feet will get washed afterwards, and Pippet will start take you through a range of amazing food. Mm-hmm. So having that with traditional owners in the Tweed Coast is something I think all people would love. We've taken people to the creeks, for example, Kujun Creek. There's acacia branches where you can pull off here, you put into the water, and it stuns the fish. So when you've got large mullet, like mullet are on the run at the moment in the creek, you can basically stun them so you can pick them up. Wow. So it's kind of the easy way to fish, blackfellow style. So people were interested in doing that. So I've got another cousin that takes people out to do that, particularly in the waterways, who loves doing that. And so we were together. I created a platform, Curry Country. You can currycountry.com, where you can book different experiences. But what you'll know is that the person who's taking you on the experience, whether it's getting yuggery, I'm going with you next Wednesday because my nieces are coming down to talk about university, and we're all doing it as a family, which would be great. But lots of people do it, you know. So we've got family that do it at Broadbeach, etc., depending on the restaurants are. And the restaurants who are keen, like, they took emu eggs off us last year, emu meat, from family who have a property near Ipswich, so they're curries that own emu property out there. So restaurants were the ones that were really open to exploring Indigenous culture on the plate in a really localised, glorious, elegant fashion. So North Rim does amazing things with our produce. Pippet does amazing things. Element, we're buying pippies for a while. Rays have shown interest. Halcyon House, Jason from there is one of the clients. So I really went to the personality of the chef.
Yeah.
Because the chef is the one who drives and creates.
Yeah.
So I wanted them to know, and we're providing some bread seeds, so some to a restaurant up in Brisbane as well. I wanted them to know, if they wanted to explore native ingredients, that we would get those native ingredients and work with them. Then, of course, Pocket Herbs came to us. Yeah. We met with them, and they wanted to start to use and grow natives in a hydroponic environment, which is absolutely aligned with where we want to be. So Curry Foundation has a contract with Pocket Herbs in which we provide and sell native foods. So it's called Native Foods by Curry Country.
And I just absolutely love all of that, being a foodie as well, and I can see that authentic connection, which is going to keep going and growing. So we're nearly up to an hour, and I could do a series on you, look out. But what I would love to know is, thank you so much for sharing that knowledge with me and your stories, and I can't wait to have more of those with you. Who and where? Because this podcast is about, you mentioned it before, people to place. So this podcast is about a people, a person and a place. So who and where? And it can be a group of.
What do you mean, who and where?
So a person or a people, a gathering of people, and a place in the world that inspires you.
I definitely think my own family, for sure. I think James and Ellen Curry inspire me again and again and again and again and again.
So what a wonderful, we've rounded an hour and here we are again. We've come back on because I actually really want to know people to place. Arabella Douglas, who and where inspires you in this world?
I'm definitely constantly inspired by James and Ellen Curry. The more I know about my great-great-grandparents, the more I understand their life and the more I know about myself. I am amazed at just the simple things, like the remedies for health within their own family that they passed on, the remedies for understanding yourself and your mind, the solutions to listening to yourself, and those practices which when you're a child you don't see as a theological practice, but now that I'm old enough I can see that their advice, their way of being, their connection to themselves sustain them. That thinking and knowing that, and that confidence and knowing that everything comes from within, that you can be centered by the earth, is profound to me. I learn more about how to do that, how to apply Aboriginal spiritual beliefs to my living daily, and I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful that I get to live on country that my great-great-grandparents walked on. I'm grateful.
So the place would have to be your country.
It is my country. If you want the best in life, this is the thing about everybody's country. There are people in the back of Brewarrina right now that feel exactly the same way about their country that I do about my country. Because if you are connected to a place, and your body will tell you whether you're connected to a place, this is not a monopoly here. I'm not the only person that has this experience. But I have this intimate relationship with this country. I encourage everybody to find the place on the planet that they have that intimate relationship with. It is profound. It's a blessing. It's a constant blessing. I never feel at a lack in life. And that mostly comes from my connection and my logical and spiritual connection to place.
Well, that's, I've got goosebumps from that one, and I feel blessed that we've had this conversation. So thank you so much today. I'm in gratitude and in awe of what you, your story. There we go. Thank you so much, Arabella.
Thank you.
We will definitely be doing a version 2 of this down the track. Adios.